This message, titled The Call, is the first of three given at a conference by the same name that featured Oz Guinness and Stuart McAllister and took place at Perimeter Church in Duluth, Georgia, May 2nd through 3rd, 2008. The Call was co-sponsored by the church and the C.S. Lewis Institute. We join the message as Bill Smith, the director of C.S. Lewis Fellows Atlanta, introduces Oz Guinness.
Our speaker this evening, Oz Guinness, has received much acclaim for his book published in 1998, The Call, Finding and Fulfilling the Central Purpose of Your Life, in which he writes, "Answering the call of our Creator is the ultimate why for living, the highest source of purpose in human existence. Apart from such calling, all hope of discovering purpose will end in disappointment. Nothing short of God's call can ground and fulfill the truest human desire for purpose." Undoubtedly, Oz has discovered his unique calling as an author and social analyst. My first exposure to Oz Guinness was in the mid-80s when I first read his book, The Dust of Death, which is an excellent social critique of the 60s counterculture. Probably many of you have read this book as well. Since that first book, published in 1973, he has written or edited over 25 books, including The American Hour, Unspeakable, Facing Up to Evil in an Age of Genocide and Terror, and just this year, as was mentioned, The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. And we'll hear more about that tomorrow. I look forward to hearing about that. Oz himself has a fascinating life story. He was born in China to medical missionaries in 1941 and is the direct descendant of Arthur Guinness, the famous Dublin brewer. From the age of 10, he was educated in England, and he holds a PhD in social sciences from Oxford University. Oz has studied with Francis Schaeffer at Le Brie, and Oz was a freelance reporter with the BBC, and in 1984 moved to Washington, D.C. He later served as executive director of the Williamsburg Charter Foundation, which celebrates the First Amendment. And in 1991, he helped to form the Trinity Forum and served as senior fellow there until 2004. He continues today to speak internationally to government, political, and university groups, and he writes extensively on topics such as faith, society, and public policy. He currently lives in McLean, Virginia, with his wife, Jenny, and so now, join me now as we give a warm welcome to Oz Guinness.
Thank you. Tremendous privilege for me to be here. I often work with the C.S. Lewis Institute in Washington, and occasionally with Ravi Zacharias and the things when they come to town or in other places, and I've long heard of this church. My son is a great friend of the son of your pastor. So I've long heard of his church, so I look forward to coming, and this will be a stimulating time for me. I can always tell which parts of the country I'm in when people respond to when it's mentioned that I'm the great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, the brewer. Oh, great. Some parts, there's a sort of disapproving silence. I always like to remind people that many of the greatest European breweries were founded by Christians. Because in those days, you had on the one hand dirty water. This is before modern plumbing and so on. So you had unhygienic water on one side. On the other side, you had the rampant social problem of the gin craze. And so literally, Christians drank beer. And many of the greatest European breweries were founded by Christians. And certainly ours was. And for many years, we were the greatest, largest brewery in the world, and we were for a long time Ireland's most generous philanthropists based on the profits. And being Christian, my ancestors used to give away millions and millions and millions to the homeless, and people without houses and all sorts of things, always anonymously, because as Christians, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, and so on. But you can imagine that sort of the time with the drink sometimes got them into complications. One of our favorite stories is a true story. The family was asked to rebuild St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is Ireland's largest church. And they agreed. It was falling down. And the city fathers came to them when it was about to be reopened, and they said, would they make an exception and allow for a very discreet thank you to the Guinness family? And they said no. The city fathers kept bugging them, and they finally said, if you promise, it'll be tasteful and discreet. Then when the curtains went up on the stained glass window, and you can see it today, the city fathers, who obviously had not been to this church with good biblical interpretation, they had put a verse from the Bible at the bottom with thanks to the Guinness family and so on. Do you know what they chose? You can see it today. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. Ah, well. Now, Terry said he'd heard this talk how many times? Good grief. I hardly ever repeat talks. And this is the only topic I ever agree to do it on, because it is so basic to where we are today. So if I completely break down in the middle, we know who to call to take over. Let me set this, though, in the context of our current challenges. There's a story of the end of the 19th century in Europe when the great German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck was dying. And a friend said to him, Otto, what will be the decisive factor in the 20th century? And Bismarck answered very famously, it will be the fact that Americans speak English. Now, Stuart and I might dispute that you speak English. Of course, he might dispute that I speak English with his Scottish accent and vice versa. That wasn't what he was talking about. In Bismarck's time, the British Empire was the largest, strongest force on earth, and within 20 years had declined and failed. And into the vacuum stepped the United States. And the last century was the American century. But I'm very struck by the fact that if you listen to the modern discussion, we're not there today. But what's moving is that the three big questions of the early 21st century all have a directly religious component. The first, very obvious question, will Islam modernize peacefully? We're not looking at that tonight. A monumental challenge, not inconceivable. And obviously, both as Christians and as Westerners, we have a stake in the answer. The second great question for our century, which faith will replace Marxism in China? As a Chinese leader said to me, the Communist Party is in power, but the ideology is dead. So in the vacuum, many people in China are looking to the ideology, the philosophy, the faith to replace Marxism. Will it be a revived Confucianism? A restored Buddhism? Will it be authoritarianism? Could it be materialism? Or could it be that in 50, 20 years' time, the Christian faith will be the majority faith in China? Incredibly significant, obviously, for us as Christians, but also for the entire world. But the third great question comes close to home. Will the Western world, our part of the world, will it sever or recover its roots? No great civilization prevails if it cuts its roots. And yet the West, which is shaped largely, partly by the Greeks, partly by the Romans, but largely by the Jewish and Christian faith, is on the edge of decisively severing that link. Europe, almost completely, and the United States increasingly in the leadership institutions. Now that's part of the context in which we find ourselves as followers of Jesus. We seek to be faithful to Him in a most extraordinary moment in history. And if you start to relate that challenge of being faithful to Christ in this extraordinary moment, there are only a certain number of deep biblical truths that we need to explore to have the strength and integrity to be able to face the hour in which we're living. And one of them is undoubtedly calling. And I put it there quite deliberately So we take it out of seeing it as just spiritual or something like that, or religious truth, but really anchor it in the fact it's partly being faithful to Jesus and partly the challenge of being faithful to Jesus with the extraordinary challenges of our modern global era. Now, there's a couple of ways you could go into calling. In the book, and usually I start with the more personal way. I'll come to it. But let me start with a more public way. Do you know the story of Osama bin Laden's favorite writer? A man called Said Qutb, an Egyptian radical. But he came to the United States as a student in the 1940s. In other words, white picket fence America. The 1940s innocence was still intact. And he went to university, not in Berkeley, not at Harvard, but in Colorado, the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley. But if you read the book of his description of his time in America, he was profoundly revolted by what he saw. And one of his comments on the church, this is the 1940s, one of his comments on the church was, it was suffering, he used two words, grotesque schizophrenia, or elsewhere he called it hideous schizophrenia. In other words, the Christian faith, even in the 1940s, was not integrated. A scholar later in the 60s in California went around all the Californian churches on a research trip and made the famous remark that the Christian faith in California was privately engaging, publicly irrelevant. Hideously schizophrenic. Privately engaging, publicly irrelevant. Now, if you think the three great biblical faiths, the Abrahamic faiths, all have an insistence on integration. Jews are called to integrate their faith under the Torah. Muslims are called, as we know very well today, to integrate their faith under the Quran or the Sharia. And of course, we as followers of Jesus are called to integrate our faith under the Lordship of Christ. But Said Qutb was saying that as Muslims, they still did it. But Christians, and as he said later, Jews, had succumbed to our modern world in the West, and their faith had become privately engaging, publicly relevant. Now, you can immediately see to the extent that that's true, such faith, on the one hand, is unfaithful. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, but do not do the things I say? A non-integrated faith is unfaithful. But not only that, it no longer has the capacity, the integrity, the effectiveness to be salty, to be light-bearing, because it covers every aspect of the disciples' life. And such faith, obviously, is very weak. And so you have the situation, the huge majority of Americans are Christians, and yet we have the situation in this country that we have. And tiny groups, far smaller than we are, gays, lesbians, and others, have in various areas influence far greater than we have, simply because of the way they integrate their faith with the whole of their life, and so on. That's a public way looking in. If we're to have any hope of truly being faithful to Jesus and have integrity and effectiveness in our world today, we have to recover the full integrity of discipleship, and there simply is no truth for doing that like calling. How about the personal way in? I start the book with the story of the first Trinity Forum we had in Europe, just outside Oxford. And at the end of our forums, we always used to have a time of wrap-up and sharing, and a very, very wealthy man, American actually, was sharing with the others, and he said simply, as you know, I made a lot of money in my life. And you could almost see people looking at each other, and they knew he had. He said, if I'm really honest, one of my driving motivations was to make money to be able to hire people to do what I don't like doing. And everyone thought he was working up to some quip. But he almost choked up, and a little single tear rolled down his well-tanned cheek. And he said, But I've never been able to hire anyone to discover my purpose in life. Here was a man of incredible wealth. But for all that, he still did not know his purpose in life. You take something like Rick Warren's book, A Purpose-Driven Life. The way it struck a chord, not just with the mega millions buying it across ordinary circles, but the leaders, the highest levels of business and politics who've read that book, got in touch with Rick, because they too are searching for purpose. The fact is, as we look around the world today, our world is a supermarket of possibilities for people looking for identity, looking for purpose, looking for fulfillment. But if you think of it, many of the answers are not that deeply satisfying. There are broadly two great rivals to the Christian view. One would be the Eastern view, Hinduism, Buddhism, they broadly overlap at this point. And if you were to say, in the Eastern understanding, what is it that gives the individual purpose and individual fulfillment, and so on? Putting it a little crudely, the East would say, forget it. Forget it. In other words, our sense of individuality is the fact that we're caught in this world of illusion. And we're going round and round and round in the cycle and reincarnation and so on. And the problem isn't that we're going to die. The problem is when you die, you're reborn and you go round again. And the longer you take yourself seriously as an individual, the more you're caught in the world of illusion. And the only freedom is not freedom to be an individual. It's freedom from individuality. And the East, in essence, says about purpose, forget it. On the other hand, the main rival in the West is obviously the secular and humanist view. And you could put that very simply, do it yourself. Man makes himself, as the Renaissance put it simply. In other words, we as human beings are born in an absurd world that comes from chance and is moving towards extinction. So we find ourselves in a world without any meaning. So we can't go out in the world and discover meaning. There's none there. If there's to be meaning, we have to create it ourselves. Or as Bertrand Russell says, we each have to be Atlas, carrying the world of our self-created meaning on our own shoulders. Do it yourself. Which, of course, is incredibly appealing to the young, the strong, the wealthy at a certain age. And many of you are still under 30, you're still immortal. But many of you realize that the big questions of our global world, the do-it-yourself answers, are awfully lonely and often incredibly bleak, as many of the great secular humanists were. Not surprisingly, the deepest answer for purpose in all history is calling. The idea that there is a personal infinite God behind everything. And he has created us, every one of us, unique. So you are like no one else who's ever lived on the earth. But we're not just created, so purpose is discover who you are. No. We're created, but the same Lord who created us calls us. And as we rise to answer that call, we go further, we go higher, we go deeper than we ever would have done on our own. And he knows not just who he's created us to be, but who he's calling us to be, who he imagines we will be. And he has things in mind for us that we could never dream for ourselves. Even our best friends or our family or our colleagues, they could never see the possibilities, the potentialities in us. And the God who creates us calls us, and we become what he's calling us to be. And not surprisingly, you have the most incredible view of unique individual purpose and fulfillment as people follow Christ. Now, let me very simply tonight, because this isn't a complicated, that's why I didn't put any outline in the talk. I will tomorrow. First of all, define calling. Secondly, give some explanations of some of the definitions we need to hold in mind, if you define it. And then I think, for me very importantly, pick up some of the great master themes. If you live a life following the call of Jesus, what does it mean in terms of inspiration and daily life? But the definition, I think, is very, very simple. Calling simply means that when God in Jesus says, follow me, everything you are, everything you have, everything you do becomes your response to his summons to follow him and become the person he sees you can be. It's as simple as that. But let's add a few definitions to clear up some of the confusions, because if you look down through history, 2,000 years, this truth bursts out again and again and again and then grows cold and grows surrounded with all sorts of confusions and barnacles and so on. And we're living in a day of enormous confusion again when it needs to be rediscovered in its power and its freshness. First of all, consider the distinction the reformers used to make. The distinction between the primary call and the secondary call. The primary call is by the Lord, to the Lord, for the Lord. Calling is always to him. Now I say that because calling, we use the word rightly, people are called to be a lawyer, called to be a homemaker, called to be a high school teacher, called to be a computer scientist, whatever it is. Calling does include the places we go to, the things we do, and so on. But first and foremost, it's not to somewhere, it's not to something, it's to someone. We are followers of Jesus. Properly understood, our culture uses the word calling, but they've no right to it, because unless there's a caller, there is no calling. Calling is first and foremost to him. But, as the reformers pointed out rightly, such a him that it's unthinkable that anything we do, anywhere we go, is not done to him. So it includes all the places we go, all the things we do. And they, the reformers said, are our secondary calling. So we're called to him, but one woman's a lawyer. Another's a high school teacher. One man is a politician. Another's an astronaut or whatever. So those are our secondary callings. Now you see the word calling there is actually a misnomer, because that's not a calling, it's an answering. We're following him and answering his call as lawyers, as high school teachers, as football stars, whatever it is. The primary call, the secondary call. The great problem is when we separate the two. That's where the trouble comes. Well, take a second distinction the reformers used to make. There's an important distinction, and this is very important in our modern Western world, important distinction between individual calling and corporate calling. Every follower of Jesus has a corporate call, a collective call, a common call. Why? Because when we follow Jesus, along with all other followers of Jesus, there's certain things he called all his followers to do. We're all called to be holy as our Father is holy. We're all called to be peacemakers. We're all called to be poor in spirit, etc., etc., all sorts of things. That is our common or collective or corporate calling. Now, that's important because in our Western society, we're all individualists, almost atomistically so. And so naturally, we forget that we're also corporate people. And every follower of Jesus shares the corporate calling of reflecting the way of Jesus and showing the way of Jesus and so on. Not surprisingly, how can the world, I'll say this tomorrow, how can the world look at Christians in politics and write books like American Fascists or American Theocrats just by looking at the church? Clearly, the church they were looking at was not following Jesus in the way that Jesus called them to. We have a common calling, and all of us together have to submit to that, undertake that, because together we're all followers. It's not just you and me as individuals. But we are individuals. We're all unique individuals. And so each of us has an individual calling as well as the corporate calling. And at that level, we have a unique calling and a blend of gifts that no one else, as I said, is exactly like. And our privilege is to follow both the common calling of all Christians and the individual calling of each of us as followers of Christ, created in the image of God, who's unlike everyone else who's ever lived. We're unique. But there's a third, and I think another important distinction, very important today. The words here are not good. But the distinction between the normal call, or the ordinary call, although the call of Jesus is not ordinary in any way, and the very special call, or the exceptional call. What do I mean? You can see in Scripture that everyone has a calling. So the idea that you can be a follower of Jesus and you don't know your calling is all wrong. We're only Christians because we follow Jesus, and that is our basic calling. We all have that calling to follow him, do whatever he's taught us and shown us to do. None of us are without calling. But there's no question that some people have a special calling and have heard a direct supernatural word from the Lord through the Scriptures, maybe through the Holy Spirit, to do a certain thing the Lord has set them apart for. Now, often, but not always, that's because the Christian community or the Lord's people at their time are not doing what they're supposed to do. So you take the prophets in the Old Testament. Amos. Amos was not a professional prophet. As he comes on and he answers when they challenge him, I'm not a prophet or even the son of a prophet. What was he? He was a farmer. But the people who are supposed to be the prophets, who are called to be prophets, had become false, professional, voices of the wrong side. So the Lord didn't use them. He picked a farmer and brought him from his farm right into Samaria to confront the people. He was called with this special supernatural call. And we all know stories of people like that. They're doing their ordinary, normal calling, whatever it is, medicine or whatever, and God calls them dramatically to something different. Now, the point is important for this reason. We all have a calling. So none of you should ever think, I don't have a calling. Just to follow what Jesus has called us to do with the people we are, boy, what a task that is. We all have an incredible calling. If God wants to show you something else, take you somewhere else, that's his privilege. But it's not everyone. Here's the problem. Obviously, the stories of people with a special call are dramatic. I mean, wouldn't you like a vision like Paul's, the man from Macedonia, tonight, to show you what you should do next year? Be wonderful. The clarity of it is wonderful. We'd all love that. Wouldn't we all love to hear the Lord audibly? Once in my life, I've actually heard the word of the Lord audibly, just once, not usually. But the trouble is, you say, have a surgeon in Manhattan, incredibly successful, and the Lord supernaturally speaks to him and sends him to serve the poor in Zambia. Now, you've got a dramatic story of sacrifice and all that sort of stuff. Obviously, pastors, writers will love it, and they tell the story. But then what happens, all us good lay people, I'm a lay person, we listen to these dramatic stories and they think, wow, I haven't been called like that. Obviously, I haven't been called at all. In other words, the experience of the minority becomes the expectation of the majority, who then feel they're inadequate if they hadn't heard something dramatic, audible, supernatural like that. And that's a fallacy. We're all called, and we've got a full-time task, taking who we are, the gifts God has given us, and following him in the way he's taught us in the Gospels. That's enough. Boy, that's huge. We don't have to have the special, and we need to be very careful. If the Lord wants to speak to you that way, he can. But you're not inadequate in any way if he doesn't. He knows the people he wants to send and where he sends them. Now, those are all sort of technical, theological distinctions. Let's move on, for me, far more importantly, to some of the great master themes. If you live a life, you've signed on because you've heard the call of Jesus. You know who you are, the gifts you have, and you're following him. What sort of things does that mean if you do that for a lifetime? Let me pick up just three. And there are many, many more in the book. First, to follow Jesus means to do what you are. It means to do what you are. In our world, you are what you do. I don't know about Atlanta, but in Washington, if you go to any reception, cocktail party, political things, whatever, you don't know the person, within about 20 seconds, someone's saying, what do you do? I'm a half, two-thirds of Washington are lawyers. You've immediately got them pegged, and so on. We are what we do in the modern world, but that's not the biblical way. The Lord has created us, calls us to do what we are. Now, of course, we're living in a fallen world. And in a fallen world, not every situation, not every job will fulfill who we are. And we have to, because of the curse of sin and so on, make work do by the sweat of our brow and so on. But still, calling addresses us as who we are, to be who we are, and to exercise the gifts God has given us before Him. I use the story in the book of Yehudi Menuhin. Not a Christian. Grew up as a Jew. Later in his life, became rabid New Ager. But you could see this principle even in him who didn't accept the Lord. In a Jewish home in San Francisco, very poor, his family were very musical. And from the age of 3 onwards, they took him to the San Francisco Symphony, and he was fascinated, not with the conductor, not with the first trumpeter, but with the violinist. And he became one of the world's great maestros and one of the world's great violinists and owns several Stradivariuses and so on. He says at the age of 3, he was fascinated with the first violinist. And he said to his father, could he have a violin for his birthday when he was 4? Now, it was a very poor family, and he didn't realize how much they cost. And later in his life, he had 2 or 3 Stradivariuses. But at that stage, he was a very poor boy. But his father was humoring him, loved the fact he loved music, and told a friend. And the friend, to humor him, gave him a toy violin made of metal with metal strings. And as an 80-year-old, Menuhin described as a 4-year-old getting this wretched toy violin. And he said, I knew even as a 4-year-old that for me to play was to be. And that this thing was grotesque, and he smashed it on the ground in front of his father and his father, not realizing how gauche that was, with his birthday present. Now, what he was saying, of course, geniuses usually have one massive gift, take someone like Mozart, that bursts through earlier. Most of us don't. I'm not a genius. Probably most of us in the room aren't geniuses tonight. We have a much more modest range of gifts and probably more diverse. But as we grow up, as Graham Greene says, there's always a moment when the door opens and the future beckons, when you're doing something that is you. So you, you're happy, just you don't need a lot of money. You don't need huge amounts of praise. It's so you that you're happy being you, and so on. Gerard Manley Hopkins said, what I do is me, for that I came. He was a Christian poet. Now, as I said, in a fallen world, we can't always do what we are. And for the Puritans who taught this, they stress that calling gave people the ability to do the humble and the menial and the humdrum and the wretched. And even that was elevated because it was done as unto the Lord, not as humble, but as something that was a part of calling. And many people in our world in history, and many people in other parts of the world that are poorer today, just have to do what they have to do as unto the Lord, and it lifts it. But our great privilege in the advanced modern world with more prosperity, almost everyone, middle class or higher, has the capacity to choose something that fits them. In other words, calling has nothing to do with aptitude tests from psychology and that sort of stuff, but really coming to know who you are before the Lord and what your giftedness is before the Lord, and then taking that and saying, Lord, how can I multiply that to your glory? For the Puritans, that was the meaning, part of the meaning of the parable of the talents and the pounds. It wasn't spiritualized. It was made very natural. You know, there's 2 versions of the story. In one, it's a master, and in the other, it's a king. Doles out talents, pounds, 1, 2, 5, 10. And then in both the stories, the master, the king, both versions, disappear. There is zero micromanagement. There is zero supervision. Now, of course, in fact, God does guide us. But in the stories, Jesus stresses it dramatically. There's zero micromanagement. And they are praised or blamed when the master, the king, comes back according to what they've done with what they were given. And the Puritans said, those are your natural gifts. Now, we all have natural and spiritual gifts, but actually, the spiritual gifts, which you see in the New Testament, are for most of us a far smaller part of our life than our natural gifts. My father-in-law, who's 90, still repairs the roof and can fix cars and things like that. You know, I'm pretty useless beyond changing light bulbs. We all have incredibly different gifts. But you think through to yourself, what is the core of your giftedness? Some of you may be hospitality, some with words, some are leaders, organizers, whatever it is. Some are good with their hands. Calling means do what you are. So you're taking whom the Lord has made you, and at the core of it, your giftedness, and multiplying it, maximizing it for His glory and to answer the world's needs. I'm always bugged the way business people sometimes tend to pretend that entrepreneurship is a business idea. No, actually, faith is entrepreneurial long before modern capitalism. Read Hebrews 11. Read the parable of the talents and the pounds. People are 1, 2, 5, 10, and they went out and made 1 more, 2 more, 5 more, 10 more. And the master says, well done. They took what he'd given them and maximized it. And that's the challenge of calling and the privilege. Do what you are. Well, take a second one, second great master theme. Calling, following Jesus, means everyone, everywhere, in everything. In other words, what I said earlier, integration. Sure, many of you saw the story of William Wilberforce in the film Amazing Grace. My great-great-grandfather was a friend of his. Wilberforce, if you remember the story, it was told sort of back to front in many ways, and many of the key parts were missed out in the film. But if you know Wilberforce's story, he was carefree, wealthy, privileged, a gambler, a whore, all sorts of other things, and came to Christ at 26. And like many people then, and many people in the time since then, he thought, I'm now Christ man. I've got to leave what I'm doing, politics, and become a minister. And you remember, he was ready to give up being an MP and become a minister. Fortunately, John Newton, a minister, said to him, for heaven's sake, don't. Don't. Stay where you are. Ask God what he wants you to do, but make that prayer where you are. And for 2 years, he prayed as a member of parliament, doing his thing, what the Lord wanted him to do. And at the end of it, you remember his famous mission statement, reckoned to be the greatest personal mission statement in all history. The Lord has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners or moral standards. Incredible that a 28-year-old would write down that. I mean, can any of you conceive of such an ambition? Which was the harder? Slavery? Which was written into the British Empire the way the defense industry is written into America, all over the place with its tentacles. Suppress the slave trade? But that was specific at least, and there was one focus of it, Parliament, and you could at least know when you'd done it. And it took him 47 years, but he did it. But the other one, the reformation of moral standards, where do you begin with corruption around? As one congressman said to me when I told the story of Wilberforce before the film came out, he said, if a little boy sees a hole in the dike, he can put his finger in. He said, what do I do when there's a mudslide? It's all around me. That's what Wilberforce must have felt like. How do you reform the moral standards of a corrupt country? He did both. But you realize he nearly missed it. What if he'd become a minister? He might have been a golden-tongued minister because he was a darn good speaker. But he would never have done what he did and became the greatest social reformer in all human history. Now, where on earth, you say, did that idea come from? If you're all out for Christ, you become a minister. goes all the way back to the 3rd century, and a gentleman called Eusebius of Caesarea, a bishop, who in one of his writings talks about the Christian life, I'm quoting now, as of two characters. What are the two types? Well, one is what he calls perfect, and the other is permitted, his words. The perfect is spiritual. Monks, nuns, priests, and their goal is spiritual contemplation. What's the permitted life, second class? It's lay people, farmers, soldiers, lawyers, and so on. But you see what happened. By the 3rd century, the lordship of Christ over the whole of life had been dualistically split. Higher, lower. Perfect, permitted. Sacred, secular. The aristocrats of the soul were the ministers. Except they call them priests and so on then. And the rest of us just muddled along as well as we could. Obviously, the church lost all its effectiveness if you had that two-tier universe. And Martin Luther shattered it in the Reformation. If you've read the Babylonian Captivity, it's not about calling, it's about the sacraments. But in two paragraphs, a couple of sentences he said blew people's minds. I mean, he says, in effect, I'm paraphrasing, the farmer in the field and the farmer's wife in the farmhouse, if they're doing what they're doing to the glory of God as a calling, that is just as high and holy as the pastor. Not higher, not holier. Those of you who are pastors, that is a high and holy calling. Those of you who are homemakers and mothers, that is a high and holy calling. It is everyone, everywhere, in everything. Now, thank God in the last 15 years, that's seeping back in, because the tragedy is, that is one of the great hallmark truths of the Reformation. And yet as time went by, evangelicals became more like the pre-Reformation Catholics. So we have notions and phrases like full-time Christian service. What are the rest of us? Does Jesus have part-time disciples? Do you live one way Monday to Friday and then Saturday, Sunday, you're a disciple again? Terrible. It is everyone, everywhere, in everything. Now, of course, that's challenging. The investment banker, how does he work out how you deal with spreadsheets and so on to the glory of the Lord? And you've got to think through every part of your world, all the spheres of your life, home, church, work, vacations, everywhere, to see that you're doing it to the glory of the Lord. In North Carolina, there's a wonderful brother who has an automotive dealership. And I've never seen a business so permeated, so that everything from the accounting to the dealing of clients has been thought through Christianly, not in language, nothing overt and crass, but the whole thing has a beauty and a justice about it that is absolutely remarkable because it's deeply integrated. No sacred secular, not at all. Everyone, everywhere, in everything. Take some time over the next week and think if every area of your life, the people you deal with, the job you do, etc., you're consistently, by God's grace, working out how you do that as unto Him. On to a third one, which is probably the theme in the book most picked up by people who write to me and so on. Following Jesus means we live before one audience, the audience of one. We live, David Riesman, the great social scientist, said, we live in what we call an other-directed world. We mock teenagers, but there's no age when people are more aware of others and what they're wearing and what they're listening to and the clothes they're into, so on. So the teenager declares his or her independence and then becomes like every other teenager in America, and so on. Now, we can mock them, but the fact is that almost all of us are like that today. And in the age of the media and its fashions and polling, 51% are doing this and so on and so on, we're all incredibly aware of others as never before, and they're starting to shape us. I use the story in the book of two great British politicians, great orators, great wartime leaders, great prime ministers, great friends, but very, very different. Winston Churchill and David Lloyd George, the Welsh prime minister. Lloyd George was actually like our modern politicians. He was incredibly attuned to people. He knew exactly where everyone around him was. Brilliant orator, but always aware of where everyone was. And one friend made a famous remark about Lloyd George, that when Lloyd George was alone in the room, there was nobody there. He was who he was only when he's turned on in front of other people. Which reminds me of a certain recent American president, but we needn't go into that. You figure out which one. Churchill was the opposite. Churchill was described as impervious to public opinion as a diver in a bell. He was brilliant at speaking to people, but he had his internal gyroscope. He influenced them, they didn't influence him. He was, as the jargon puts it, inner-directed. Lloyd George was other-directed. Now, the fact is, modern Americans are incredibly other-directed. 51% are now believing this, and we're reading that book, and we're going to this seminar. You're not doing it? You haven't got the latest BlackBerry? My goodness me. Left behind is not a matter of Tim LaHaye's theology. It's a matter of technology and cell phones and gizmos, and you can't be left behind if other people have something you don't have, Tim, and so on. This is modern America. We're incredibly other-directed. Now, the Puritans were not. And the Puritans were the one who used this phrase, the audience of one. Now, I've got to say the early Puritans, because they did it, the later Puritans lost it. You take the Puritan view of success. What is success? You're very famous or you're not. You make a huge amount of money or you don't. You're enormously acclaimed or you're completely ignored. Now, for the Puritans, that was something external in the world. Are we saved by anything external like works? No. We're saved by faith through grace before the Lord. So they described success like that, wealth and these other things, as dead works. So you couldn't care less about them. Now, that's very easy for me to say. But usually when the sting comes in, we realize how much we are depending on other people's approval or metrics like the money we make and so on. But for the Puritans, they described themselves as dead to the world, but diligent in the world to which they were dead. Now, that's actually exceedingly hard to do. But the way they did it was they were living before one audience, the audience of one. Who is your audience? We all have them. I mean, thank God, one or two here have read my books. If I didn't have a tiny audience, I have a small enough one anyway. Churchill, when he wrote his first book, a friend asked him what sort of a writer he was. He said, I'm a writer of rare books. I just didn't intend it to be that way. Well, I'm following in Churchill's eminent footsteps compared with my friend and brother, say, Rick Warren. No, we all have audiences. Politicians, that audience, wouldn't be voted in. Doctors, you go on. But the question is, which audience trumps all others for you? That's what the parable is about. Only one word should say we've been successful. Well, actually two. Well done. Well done. I personally challenge the current Christian vogue in America for thinking through your legacy. The fact is we haven't a clue what our legacy is. Now, you can know the money you leave to your children. That's sort of a financial thing. But all the people talking about legacy, what does he want to pass on? We simply do not know what the Lord is calling us to and what we've achieved until we see him face to face. And if he says, well done, that's the audience that counts. Now, that's tough. You know the story of Martin Luther, the Diet of Worms. On the first day of the trial, and you remember the last person who'd been tried that way was burned at the stake the next day, Jan Hus. So Luther knew exactly what was literally at stake. In the trial the first day, they piled up Luther's books, and they said, Martin, are these yours? Of course they were. His name was on them. I couldn't deny some of my books, even if I wanted to. His name was on them, but Luther trembled and ask for an extra day to give an answer. People thought the poor guy was cracking. I mean, he was a miner's son. No, he was a nothing. Here he is in front of all the princes and the prelates, the greatest power show the church could put on. And Luther asked this question with his life at stake. He starts to tremble and asks for a day to answer. People thought the little miner's son was out of his depth and he was cracking. Amazingly, the emperor gave him an extra day. Of course, ironically, there are even more people to hear his answer the next day. The next day, of course, we know the answer he gave. Finishing those immortal lines, "Here I stand, so help me God, I can do no other." Delivered with a ringing clarity, which is the heart of the Protestant Reformation. And his friend said to him afterwards, "Martin, how come, you know, one day you're asked if these are your books and you're almost undone by it? Were you overcome by the emperor?" "No, no," he said. "I was just terribly aware that that moment, both the emperor and I were standing in the presence of the King of Kings." Can you imagine being on trial for your life, knowing that there's a fire waiting for you out there with this enormous power and huge opposition to him, and he was aware of one audience, the audience of one? Can't start with just inspiring stories, but think through the tough things of that. For example, the ethical implications. One of our problems in the modern world is anonymity. Why are so many people doing such crazy things? Because they're anonymous. Now, in a fallen world, the simple fact is that morality is accountability according to visibility. People in a fallen world, this is not what should be, but what is in a fallen world, people do what's right because they're seen, not just because it's right. They don't do what's wrong because they're seen, not just because it's wrong. In a fallen world, don't misunderstand me, in a fallen world, I'm not being cynical, morality is partly relative to accountability and visibility. Now, that creates a huge problem in the modern world because with modern mobility, more people, not just Christians, but people of all sorts, more people are more anonymous in more situations than ever before. It might be travel. New business leaders are in Asia tomorrow night and you finish your business. What do you do in the evening? We don't know. Or teenagers come home from high school and they're down there. It could be technology. They're down on the internet. Parents 30 feet away. No idea of the things that they're into on the internet. We are more anonymous in more situations than human beings have ever before in history. And the question is, what do we do when we're unseen? But of course, as followers of Jesus, we may be unseen by our parents or our friends or our spouses or our colleagues or our fellow church members. Take accountability. You know, huge vogue and a proper vogue for accountability. But a lot of people are far too naive about it. For instance, you can have two people in New York or Atlanta or LA or whatever, and you get together once a week as an accountability group. But the fact is you haven't seen each other since the previous week. So I've got my friend X whom I'm meeting. I'm asking him to hold me accountable. I've got to tell him everything I've done this week to which he holds me accountable. He hasn't a clue if everything I told him is the full truth. Now, it's not like the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker who lived in the little village or the small town. They saw everything each other did. If they held each other accountable, that was real accountability. No pulling the wool over their eyes, but today, even accountability, we can be anonymous. All this talk in America about transparency, it's partly good, but partly it's utopian. None of us are transparent in this anonymous mobile world. But as Christians, we need to remember we live before one audience, the audience of one. And it has incredible ethical implications. Enough from me, and I want to leave plenty of time for you. But think it through for yourself. Calling it as at the heart of the life of Jesus. Follow me. Two words that change the world. It is not just a little theological doctrine, a spiritual, pious truth. It is a truth which when you enter into shapes your life and inspires you as a great master theme wherever you are, wherever you go. Finding and fulfilling the core purpose of your life. Over to you.
Yeah, I'd like to know the name of the car dealer in North Carolina. But besides that, other examples like that where men in the marketplace and women in the marketplace have taken their faith and integrated it into the, you know, to their business procedures and processes.
Well, I will mention the brother whom I was praising. His name is Don Flo, F-L-O-W, in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I mention him because he's got a very interesting paper on how he applied Christian faith and ethics to his business. It's Flo Automotive. But there are many today in the last 50 years. You take, say, lawyers. The Christian Legal Society has got a study called the Lawyer's Quest, which helped lawyers think through how you treat clients, how you deal with billable hours. In other words, every ramification of being a lawyer today has to be thought through Christianly. And they've done a good job on like that. And the Christian Medical and Dental Society are trying to do their own sort of thing. And you see people all over the place beginning to try and do this. Of course, in some areas, it's very tough. I mean, Steve Reinemann, the former chairman of Pepsi, who's going to Wake Forest as the dean of the business school. Steve is a wonderful brother. And he describes to his own cost, he came up through Frito-Lay and then became the chairman of Pepsi. And I think about 6 weeks after he'd been there, his daughter came to him, teenage daughter, and said, "Dad, you're really concerned to integrate your faith with Pepsi. How come Pepsi supports, I can't remember the number, but a huge number of the worst films every year around the world?" He looked into it. Sure enough, in their cultural wing, they were supporting some of the most dreadful things. Now, when you've got an aircraft carrier like Pepsi, you can't turn it around like, say, an owner of a personal business like Don Flo. It's his business. Everything can easily be related tomorrow if he sees something. Steve has the challenge of working out how he deals with that in turning around an aircraft carrier and so on. So I'm not saying it's a simple thing. But it's wonderful to see so many brothers and sisters across this country now wrestling with the implications of their faith in their public lives. And I hope all of us will become a part of that.
Apart from a really specific exceptional call like you talked about, could you talk about, I guess, the freedom that we have in Christ in determining a call that's not an exceptional call?
Yeah. We have freedom, but we have responsibility. Because the one man in the parable who's condemned is the man who does nothing. And I say that because one of the problems of our modern age, we have such a range of choice. Choice and change are at the heart of our modern world, and never more so than this generation. So one of the features, say, of those under 30 is a refusal psychologically to close on things. And you can see people doing that with their callings. And in America, we're all middle class and higher. Incredible range of things. The world is our oyster. We have a range of gifts. You can do all sorts of, what on earth do we do? And some people, just at the end of the day, do nothing. And we need to remember that challenge. We've got to do something to multiply, maximize. So there is a very legitimate place. I personally think the 20s are a wonderful decade for experimentation. And often with discovering calling, all the wrong things are a good prelude to the right thing. And if, say, someone, I'm just making it up, someone has 10 gifts, very obvious gifts, and they try 8 of them and hit their heads against the wall, they'll get towards the one that's right. And certainly, I mean, I went a little of the Wilberforce way. I came to Christ in the early 60s, and in those days in England, if you're all out for Jesus, it was the ministry, mission field, evangelism. My parents are missionaries, so I knew that wasn't for me. I almost comically tried for a while to be an evangelist. It was the heyday of Billy Graham, and I was invited to lead an evangelistic crusade in Ireland. It happened to be in the town where Ian Paisley, if any of you know British politics, Ian Paisley, the arch Protestant, was the Pope in that town. And I made the great mistake in that town of reading out of the Revised Standard Version of the Bible. This is 1966. The church was picketed every single night of the week by 100 people. No one could get into the evangelistic meetings by Paisley's people who thought you should had to read King James or nothing. So my attempts at evangelism finished with a sort of comic failure. And then I thought, well, I must be a minister. And I went down to a church. I wasn't ordained, mercifully, in my case. I went down to a church in the south of England for 6 months and absolutely hated it. I loved the people, but I hated it. And one day I had an old 50-year-old car, a 1927 car, and I took it into the gas station. In those days there was no self-service, and the man did it. It was a car you had to crank at the front. And I had a wonderful conversation with him for about 20 minutes. And I got back in the car, and I realized he's the first non-Christian I'd spoken to in several weeks. And it just crystallized for me what bugged me about wonderful church, wonderful people, but it wasn't me. I love engaging the world with ideas and culture and so on. And to be in something that's womb to tomb Christian, I was so frustrated I couldn't put a handle on it. And then someone gave me William Perkins's book on calling, and it just blew my mind. God had something for me. And that was the no. I remember a number of years later when I was pretty sure what it was I was to do. I came back from Europe, and I was asked, if any of you know the name Martin Lloyd-Jones, I was asked to be the minister of that church. Now, he'd retired, and the next man had emptied the church, and it was down to about 200 instead of thousands. And I wondered if this was God's calling for me. And my wife will tell you, I sweated that weekend with the horror that I was maybe called to the ministry after all. Those of you who are called to the ministry, that is your gift and your freedom. I sweated with a nightmare of the horror that maybe I was called to that. And then I realized I wasn't and said no. And I have never looked back. And the moment of freedom when I said no to that group of elders, I was not called to be a minister. Oh, it was liberation. And so there are many no's before you find the yes, and I think that's perfectly legitimate. But you're always searching for that thing's the core of your giftedness to do before the Lord. Okay.
The story of Wilberforce is obviously incredibly inspirational, and he knew clearly the what, the abolition of the slave trade and the reformation of morals. The how was daunting. What would you say to somebody who had a pretty clear view of what the what is? I know what I'm called to, what I want to do, what is me, but the how seems to kill the dream, mm-hmm. kill the desire, because it simply probably won't happen. What would you say to somebody who struggles with the how to accomplishing the what?
Now, of course, most of us, this is not quite the answer to the question yet, most of us are not like Wilberforce. In our Trinity Forum readings, we have the story of Wilberforce contrasted with Solzhenitsyn. Solzhenitsyn uses the word calling at the very end. So he comes to faith and he stumbles through various things into writing and becomes the great writer. Only later does he look back and see that all along he'd followed the dots, you know, and his calling was spelled out by what he'd done, and he sees the clarity looking back. Now Wilberforce looks forward. Maybe it's the Lord's mercy that he's given this huge thing from the age of 28, and his challenge is, as you say, how? Now, come to your question, though, how? Obviously, one of his secrets was others. If he didn't have the Clapham Circle, he would have got so discouraged, he would have given up. He needed others. And they weren't just supports for him. He was described as the prime minister of a cabinet of philanthropists. And in those days, philanthropy wasn't giving money, it was doing good. So one person did that, one another. They did a whole range of things, but together they gave each other strength. And with many of us who have tough jobs, you know, we need a lot of other people who are really standing around us. Otherwise, you get discouraged and, you know, the Elijah syndrome, I am left, and we get self-pitying and so on. We need others. Well, take a second thing among many things I could pick out, a commitment to perseverance. The time I mentioned when I spoke in the Congress on Wilberforce, Dick Armey, who'd introduced me, who was then the Republican leader, he said to me, that would be impossible here. He said, I can't get members of Congress to concentrate for 5 weeks, maybe 5 months, of 5 years, let alone 47 years. Now, Wilberforce was committed for a lifetime. And it's that sort of challenge, build into young people, build into ourselves. We're in this for the duration, and so on. So, bring on others. Many of our fellowship groups don't bring in the idea of calling. They have good Bible study, they have good prayer, you know, someone's really messed up, they encourage them, whatever. But a good fellowship group, every one of the 6, 10, whatever it is, should know what everyone else's sense of calling is. So we're always inspiring, encouraging, affirming, because each of us at times will be down. You know, we'll get worn down, and we need to be re-inspired, and re-encouraged, etc. So I would say whatever group you're in, inject that notion of calling. So everyone knows what your calling is. You know what mine is, or whatever it is. We need others, and we need the long-term perspective.
It seems as if there is a distinct separation in churches between the church world and the working world. Work is not often referred to in a church setting, and churches often don't spread out into the world. What's the best antidote to that situation?
It's got to be multifaceted. It's got to be first teaching. Because the rot starts with teaching that's more like Eusebius, spiritual, secular, higher, low, and so on. You've got to have good teaching. Our rector would be the first to say, I go to a church which is founded by George Washington, a wonderful Anglican church, a wonderful brother. But two of us, one of whom was his best friend and myself, we hammered at him because he taught quite explicitly and implicitly in 100 ways that the highest thing was to become a minister or a youth director. And we sent out scores of both. And we hammered away at him for probably 10 or 15 years, got nowhere and gave up. And to our surprise, one day in a church magazine, there was a headline, I was wrong. And the rector had put in that he'd seen the light on this, not through us, but through someone else. But then came the challenge. It wasn't just a sermon or two each year that had the holistic vision. For instance, in our church, you just listen to the prayers. So in the prayers, which are wonderful, heartfelt prayers, most of them were about missionaries and camps, crusade workers, and navigator people, and so on. But our church has senators, congressmen, attorney general, you know, television people like Fred Barnes, wealthy mega billionaires who shall be unnamed. They're all there, sitting there. The White House speechwriter. You go on down the line. They were never prayed for. So you had the campus crusade worker in France or whatever. In other words, even the prayers said the spiritual is higher, the secular is not important. Now, one of the simple reasons for that, and here's something very odd. If you ask who are the most alienated people in the church in America, it's the artist. Artists, painters, and so on are hardly ever referred to. Very few churches have a healthy biblical view of encouraging artists. But this is more surprising. Who are the second most alienated people? Business leaders. Now, if you think, there's a very simple reason. Most pastors are fabulous at preaching to people in marriage situations when the messes are there. Very simple reason. They hear the anguish and the heartache and the breakdown in their offices and their studies. And so when they're preparing sermons, thinking of illustrations, you know, Mrs. X, Tom, so-and-so, they're in their minds, and they immediately, without realizing it probably, just reach out with illustrations and a word here that reaches into the anguish of marriage situations. But do they have a clue of the boardroom? No, not a clue. And pastors have to make an intentional effort to go out. So our rector now goes down to have lunch with politicians on Capitol Hill, with business people, and say, no, tell me about your world. What are the dilemmas? Where is it hardest to bring your faith in? Listen to them. And slowly he knows something he says, but it's got to be brought back into the teaching, to the prayers, to every part of life of the church. But there are groups. You know, you've got your group, Life Work Leadership, and other people here in the South. Many are good groups here in Atlanta doing a good job around the country. It's happening, but all too slowly.
Now, Oz, how would you describe the overall response you've received to your book and message over the past decade? And perhaps secondly, weighing everything in light of God's sovereignty, are you pessimistic or optimistic about the future of America?
Boy. In two words or three? In terms of books, it's often said that every author's favorite book is the current one. I wouldn't say that. I'm very aware of which books mean everything to me and which books are significant and which aren't. But of the many books I've written, The Call is undoubtedly done by far the best. But there's another book that means everything to me equally. It didn't do anything. And it Long Journey Home, which did relatively nothing compared with The Call. But I am grateful for the way The Call has been picked up all around the place. I'm very grateful because calling is at the heart of the struggle for the recovery of integrity in our world. And actually, The Call is sold as well in places like Korea as it sold in, it outsells in Korea the English sales in my home country and so on. No, I'm deeply grateful for that. America, well, that's a harder one. I've been asked to speak to the C.S. Lewis Institute with your wonderful brother from here, Ken Boer, in October in Washington, and he's evidently got a lecture, CD or DVD or something, on the fall of Rome. Some of you may have seen it. I haven't seen it. I will see it before I speak to him. So I'm not referring to Ken specifically, but a lot of people look at the decline and fall of countries like Rome and then show the parallels with America, you know, moral decadence, et cetera, et cetera. I would look at it a different way. The framers set up this country a certain way, and the deepest question they wrestled with was, can freedom last forever? Freedom never lasts. It either runs into license, or it's so concerned with itself that it breeds a security which undermines freedom, or it fights for itself, freedom, in ways which contradict freedom. Freedom never lasts. The framers knew that. And they ransacked Greeks and the Romans, classical antiquity, to know why freedom didn't last, and they built the system to beat the odds. They ransacked history to defy history. Now, it surprises Americans, particularly secular scholars. You say, how did the framers think freedom would last? Well, the polls show 90% of Americans would say the Constitution. No. For the framers, the Constitution was only half of it. The other half actually had no name. I call it the Golden Triangle of Freedom. Tocqueville calls it the Habits of the Heart. And put it very simply, for the framers, freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires faith of some sort, and faith requires freedom. And like the recycling triangle, that goes round and round and round ad infinitum. Freedom requires virtue, which requires faith, which requires freedom, which requires virtue, etc., etc. Now, that second half is totally ignored today, except in July the 4th rhetoric and so on. In other words, the framers' solution as to why freedom could last has been abandoned, which leads you to the question, well, how do modern Americans think it'll last? Well, they say things, well, the framers relied on that sort of thing, but we have law. But without the habits of the heart, you'll have endless laws and regulations and litigation. That's happening. Or we have technology. And you know the bumper sticker, under one nation under surveillance. You can see today America has abandoned the framers' way, and this generation will show whether the framers are right or wrong. We're reaching the critical point after which, if the framers are right, America can only decline. Now, there's a way of reversing that and renewing things, restoring things. That's another topic. But I think America's at a very, very significant stage. That's just a one tiny cut on it.
You refer to we are called to do what we are. And here you're talking to an audience that is privileged, middle-class America, higher, that we can think about that. How will you share the call to, third world country, Africa, for example? Most of the people are just surviving.
Well, the same way, obviously, the early church was closer to the African countries you're mentioning. But so were the Puritans. And you read, say, the poems of George Herbert. I got one of his poems in there. He talks about the man who sweeps the floor and does it as unto the Lord. And it's become a hymn, which some of you may sing. We don't sing old hymns today. We all sing stuff that's 2,000 and later. But if you sing some of the Puritan hymns, you have that notion. Those people were poor people, but drudgery was elevated if you did it as a calling to the Lord. So we've got to be very realistic about this. It is a blessing for us to be able to choose. Now, the trouble is we have over-choice, and we're often paralyzed by choice. But people in poor countries, or most of the world in history, they took what they had to do. That's what Paul says about slaves. You're under a master, but you're not serving that master. You're serving the real master in heaven, and you're doing it as unto him. So most of history has been like that, which means you take the necessary, you take the drudgery, you take the menial, the humdrum, that which you have to do to put bread on the table, and you do it as unto the Lord, and it may be miserable, but there's a elevation of it if you're doing it as unto the Lord. So we've got to be absolutely realistic about that. You could equally say, you know, our age is sometimes described as the age of authenticity, or a technical term is the age of expressive individualism. You know, so one of the buzzwords of people under 35 is you want to be authentic. You know, which you Americans say without the T, the second T, authentic. Now, the trouble is, what are we authentic to? It sounds nice, but people have no North Star. They have no idea who they are. But calling is genuine authenticity, because of being true to God's call, knowing who we actually are before him. So it's not an expressive individualism or a do your own thing in the 1960s hippie sense. You know, we are doing who we are, but not selfishly. No, it's who God has created us to be, and to his glory and to the world's needs. But your point's a very important one. We must never make calling a counter-signature for selfishness.
Do you have any advice for aspiring writers?
For what?
For an aspiring writer.
If you read great writers, which I'm not, the simple common advice is do it. Now, most writers in this country have the privilege of writing courses. I never had a sense of being a writer. Writing is not actually the heart of my calling. I do write. I've written 25 books. I never set out to be a writer, and I fell into it accidentally, and the first one did well, so I wrote a second one. And I'm learning to be a better writer than I was. I mean, I'm Oxford educated. You know, we have page-long paragraphs in Oxford. In America, you have one-line paragraphs, you know. USA Today style, I'm kidding. You know, but I was a bad writer learning to be better. But always writers say, just do it. And with the great age of word processing, in the old days, type it out painfully. I mean, to do a page over again, oh, now every day you finish with a pristine, fresh, you know, so much better. Just do it and do it and do it. And take criticism. All fresh writers, we're all too precious and sensitive. You know, don't they understand the genius behind that paragraph that they said is, you know, not the call, but the current book, The Case for Civility. I gave it to my son in draft form. And my son, being to law, some of you know him, he absolutely brutal. So it came back convoluted, complicated, crap, you know. It was just filled with C words, I mean, you know. But people said, you like tough editing? Absolutely, in the long run. I mean, editors are wonderful people. I've discovered a good editor, many of them don't want to be writers. They have a gift of taking the tortured, complicated prose that we writers put down as the first draft and actually helping us try to say what we're trying to say. But just do it, do it, do it.
The proceeding was a presentation of the C.S. Lewis Institute. In the legacy of C.S. Lewis, the Institute endeavors to develop disciples who can articulate, defend, and live faith in Christ through personal and public life. For more information, please visit our website at www.cslewisinstitute.org. Thank you.